Tell me, what can you see?
Hey, you are listening to Local Folk. That's what time it is. I am your host, Steve Carrigan, and I am here tonight. Normally, I have a live guest in the studio who is local. Now, this particular time, I have someone who's not live and not local, but he has definitely contributed to the local folk culture around here. It was a pair of them that I had the rare and wonderful opportunity to interview just a few weeks ago when they were in town, and I'll let you know who they are during the recording, actually, quite frankly. I'll tell you what, I've had a super duper busy week. If it's going to be raining out tomorrow, you can come visit me down at this my new afternoon day job at this place called ProCook. It's like an English company. There's only one of them here. It's down near the outlets near the Under Armour. Come on down, buy a cookie tin, and make some cookies for yourself. It's good stuff. You can make some English cookies. Biscuits, I think they would call them. I don't know what they call them in England. Alrighty. Hey, you know what? That's all of the info and tunes and everything that I have ready. I need to play this excellent interview that I have, and the guest is Alan Reed, and he's from the Battlefield Band. And I think I say this on the recording, so I'm not going to repeat myself too much. I just want to say that I did record this in Studio a few weeks back during Sean Henderson's program. I think there might be a little link through of music, and I think we may even mention that on the recording. All right, enough about talking what might be on the recording. Let's just play the recording. Here I am, Steve Carrigan, with Alan Reed, mostly speaking, of the Battlefield Band, right here on WSEA 106.1 FM. We are Portsmouth Community Radio. Here we go. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Local Folk, the program where we try to bring you the people that make folk culture happen here in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. I'm your host, Steve Carrigan, and I have a couple guests with me who came into town, and I'm actually recording this right now. They came in, and it's really exciting to have them here. Portsmouth, New Hampshire has a great history of folk music, and not just the people that live here, but the people that can come in and help participate in that. And we've got some real whoppers here today, as far as I'm concerned. I have with me Alan Reed and Rob Van Sant. Alan Reed was, if you don't know, was one of the founding members of the Battlefield Band back in 1969. He was with the Battlefield Band all the way through 2010, and him and Rob are now out here doing a show on their own. Before I get into it, I'll just say welcome to the show, Alan.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here, Steve.
Yes. Did I get that right so far?
Yeah, you're on a roll here.
I'm on a roll. Boy, that's great news. All right. So, Tom, you know, what I wanted to talk about really is you were just in town last week, doing a concert with Rob, who's also in the studio with us as a duet. Mm-hmm. And you've left the Battlefield Band. So before we go all the way back, let's just talk about that. You're a duet now.
Yeah, we started this duo 12 years ago, and we were doing it kind of side by side with what Battlefield Band was doing. Rob was the sound engineer with Battlefield Band for the previous 15 years. So
okay,
we were touring together with the band, and when we had time between band tours, we would do some stuff ourselves. And then a couple of years ago, I decided that I thought it'd be more interesting to do that after 41 years with Battlefield Band. You know, much as I love the bagpipes, I thought, well, let's go in a different direction and do a song act rather than a fiddle, bagpipes, guitar, and keyboards interspersed with songs act.
Okay, just to give an idea of what the Battlefield Band was about for our listeners that don't know, let's just back up a little bit. You started that in 1969?
Yes, I was actually in the second lineup. I missed the first 3 months of the first lineup. But then that first lineup got fired from a bar in Glasgow called the what was it called? Something to do with railroads. The Iron Horse, yes. because they had left their instruments in a locker at the university, so they turned up at the gig and said, "Sorry, we can't play tonight. Our instruments are locked up in a room, and the janitor's gone home." Well, boys, you're fired. So that was the end of that lineup, and I joined Mark too.
Hey, that's great. That's sort of the good luck. The artist, the musician's way sometimes is to forget things, actually. So I guess if you're a professional, you show up with
your
actual
gear. And we're still doing
it.
Well, at least I am.
Well, it's called the Battlefield Band because it formed in a region of Glasgow.
Yeah. Yes, you've been doing your homework.
I did a little bit of homework. Listen, and everybody knows that I'm not any kind of folk expert at all, but I did a little bit of homework just to be sure that I knew a little bit what was going on. Battlefield Glasgow, was that literally the name of the...
It's an area of a neighborhood in Glasgow because it was the site of a battle with Mary Queen of Scots and some Scottish nobles in 1540-something, I think it was.
Okay.
And it was the last battle prior to her fleeing from Scotland and going down to England to seek succor from our cousin Elizabeth I of England, who, as if your listeners don't know, she kept her locked up in Fotheringay Castle for 19 years and then she had her head chopped off. Hmm. So wasn't really a good move.
Not exactly.
But when Glasgow grew in the Industrial Revolution, it swallowed up what was the area of the battlefield.
Okay.
So that's why there's an area of Glasgow called Battlefield. And there's still a monument there commemorating the battle.
Is it a nice neighborhood?
Yeah, it is. It's kind of middle class, a bit kind of student-y as well.
Student-y? There's a college there or something?
There are colleges nearby, and it's in the south side of the city, which tends to be not as expensive as the north side.
Great.
Which is great if you're trying to rent an apartment.
Well, oftentimes it's great for musicians, you know. Musicians in this country, anyways, tend to go to a place, give it some flavor, and then people come in and make it real nice, and then the musicians can't live there anymore.
No, absolutely right. Brian McNeil, who was the guy who was the true founder of the band, he was in the first lineup as well. He had an apartment in that part of the city, so that's how he named the band. I didn't explain that bit, did I?
No. I don't know. Hey, the name of our band's Great Bay Sailor. We have Great Bay right outside. So, I mean, I think it's a good idea to talk about where you're from.
Absolutely. A sense of place.
Did you grow up with folk music?
No, not at all. I grew up with all kinds of music. When I was six, I loved Doris Day. But I also liked... people like Guy Mitchell. I guess my first notion of folk music was hearing something like Tom Dooley.
Tom Dooley?
Yeah, because that was a big hit in Britain, you know, around about 1957 or so. We had a thing called the Skiffle Craze, which took a lot of American songs very often, and they were hits. So that was one of my first influences musically. But when I was a teenager, I really wanted to be in a rock band.
I
wanted to be a cool keyboard player, playing organ or something like that. Something like a whiter shade of pale. That's where I saw myself. But I didn't have the money to buy the equipment. So folk music became my second choice.
So was it because it was accessible to you?
The Battlefield Band started playing together. When we started playing together, we just played anything that we liked that you could play acoustic. And that could be bluegrass, it could be country, it could be sort of folk rock stuff without the rock part of it, with a little bit of Irish thrown in. So it was very broad music that we were playing, and we were doing it just for fun. It was something that was very amateurish, I would say, for the first three or four years. until we left university, and we discovered folk clubs. It never occurred to us to play in a folk club. Our first few gigs were in noisy bars in Glasgow, where the drunk people really weren't interested in long-haired students playing stuff that wasn't country music. So it was a tough baptism, and what we developed early on was a stage presence where we told a lot of jokes and tried to grab the audience's attention that way, and then hopefully they would listen to the music that we were playing. But it didn't really work, and then someone said, well, why don't you try playing in a folk club? And we thought, a folk club? Well, what do you do there? And we went to a folk club, and we were astounded that people actually were quiet. That kind of freaked us out, actually, yeah. Because we were accustomed to bar noise and people talking and clinking of glasses and stuff like that. And the first time we went to a folk club, which is in a town called Paisley, just outside Glasgow, we were quite shocked because they could hear every note. That spooked me for the first few times, because I thought, God, I better not make any mistakes because they'll hear absolutely everything. But through that, we discovered that actually people liked what we were doing. And so we went from a good time amateur, play anything, acoustic band, to folk musicians. So we started off playing music from anywhere, and then gradually over a period of time we evolved into a folk group playing Scottish music. But it was a very roundabout way of doing it.
Well, that's a fascinating way of coming to it. I mean, a lot of people, when they are growing up and they're kids, they want to play whatever they're hearing on the radio, or they want to play any number of different things. And it sounds like, so you sat down, you found an audience, and the audience that was listening wasn't digging on the bar stuff. They were digging more on the folk stuff. Is that what happened?
That's correct. We started playing outside Glasgow. I remember the first time we went to Edinburgh, which is 44 miles away, but it's the other side of the country. So psychologically, that was a great adventure. Gosh, we're going to play in the East Coast. we're in the West Coast. And we got a great reception there because, as far as the folk clubs there were concerned, here were some young guys out of the blue coming from the West. And we got some great feedback from that. And shortly after that, we made a little trip to England. We had met this lady who said, oh, come and stay in my house in the northeast of England and I'll take you around all the folk clubs. And what you would do in those days, Steve, was you would go to a bunch of folk clubs and you would do a floor spot, which means that you would be on before the main act and you'd do two or three numbers. And if you impressed, they would say, okay, right, we'll book you, in 3 months' time, 4 months' time. So we went down to England and we played about five or six folk clubs. Didn't get paid anything for it, but it was like an addition, and out of that we got a tour. But at the same time, I remember some guy saying to me in somewhere near Newcastle, he said, why are you doing all this English stuff for? We want to hear the Scottish music.
Oh, really?
Again, that was a kind of penny drop moment where we thought, well, I guess why would English people want to hear Scottish people doing English songs? Probably not very well. So let's do our own music. So again, that further kind of gave us a direction. So again, that was a very roundabout way of discovering who we were and what we were going to do.
So you discovered and you became what you are through the act of doing, as opposed to having been born with it, on the inside. You took cues and had aha moments, so to speak.
Yeah, a little kind of obvious light bulb moments. Yeah. And that's different from, there are a lot of great young musicians in Scotland just now who have grown up with that music, but that didn't happen with our band. We kind of strayed into it and got there by accident almost.
It's a great thing to stray into.
And the thing is that in our first couple of albums, we had become so focused on being in a traditional folk group that we took ourselves way too seriously. And so we went to a kind of other ex- extreme, and it took us a couple of years to kind of loosen up a bit and say, okay, well, okay, we were playing Scottish folk music, and yes, and we, maybe we're in the vanguard of a new movement, but goodness, let's have some fun at the same time. Yeah.
Did you know that you were in the vanguard of a new movement?
Well, we thought we were. We reacted to some of the TV folk acts that were around at that time, who all, dressed in very smart clothes, and wore kind of like uniforms, and we were still a bunch of hairy, bearded guys, sort of thinking, no, we'll go on stage with our jeans and look cool, kind of like folk versions of rock bands. We still had that kind of mentality. We kind of rejected the very clean-cut folk image that was in the public mind at the time.
Okay, so you were trying to go for it. Just in case people probably will hear in the background, there's some kind of rock band playing right in the studio right next door.
That's right, and they're very good.
Actually, they are very good. You should listen to the program. It's called, Sean Henderson's program. It's on right now. So as you can tell, this is Friday. Yeah, but we walked in, we thought they sounded great, but they looked like rock stars, huh?
Absolutely, yeah. Tattoos all over the place.
Tattoos galore, yeah. Okay, so you've got the long hair and you're like, forget it. Yeah, I think they even had to clean up the Beatles, didn't they? I don't know, I thought.
Well, they had long hair, which...
Brian Epstein gave them the suits.
Right, somebody had to come and say, hey, put some suits. Did you guys want... But so just to get back on track, just for one... I just have a question, though, about taking yourself seriously. Okay?
Sure, yeah.
So once you say, all right, that is it, not only are we're not a bar band, we're a folk band, we have an audience that's listening to us, and they're telling us, play Scottish music, and then you say, all right, I'm going to do that, and then you say, okay, time to find... that music. Did you know the music, or did you have to go find it? And if was it through that research that you started to take yourself real seriously in terms of being a Scottish band? Where did you find your music, and is that...
Well, we had to look in books, basically, okay. Because taking ourselves very seriously, we didn't want to do anything that anybody else was doing. We wanted to find our own little gems of unknown traditional songs and tunes and things like that. So... And we had started recording, so that gave us, a sense of worth, but a sense of, gosh, we're doing something new here, so let's do it the best way we can, and let's find the most obscure folk song we can find. And at the same time, we were also very much influenced by the groundbreaking Irish bands,
yes,
that were around at the time, namely Bothy Band,
yes,
and Planxty.
Yep.
And they gave us that template where you didn't have to be a vocal trio or a dance band. You could mix it all up. You could be playing exciting dance music one minute and then playing a traditional song the next minute. And we got really excited with the idea of different instrumentations, and we got into very involved and sophisticated arrangements, and again that felt very innovative.
Well, just to think about the atmosphere at the time, or before some of this was happening, I've heard, and you can tell me whether or not, I heard that when people were thinking of folk music back then, they were thinking of what their grandmother listened to, or they were thinking of the type of thing that they really didn't, before you all came along and before you showed people that this folk music can be something a lot more exciting, that people were sort of saying, I don't want to get into this music because this is what my grandmother listened to, or this is what whatever else. It's not the thing that's happening right now, and yeah, it's something that happens in a parlor, not out at college where I want to meet pretty women or something, Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes. When we started out, there were certain acts that people would think of. If we said, "Oh, I play folk music," oh, are you like the Clancy Brothers?
Okay.
Or are you like the Corries, which were a kind of Scottish equivalent? Those were the guys I was thinking of when I was talking a few minutes ago about dressing up.
Oh, dressing up, okay. Yeah.
And being very clean cut and doing a very slick act. You know, we didn't want to follow that.
But people thought they were cool, though, right? The people thought the Clancys were cool. I mean, they were mainstream, right, at the time.
That's right. Yeah, I just read Tom Clancy's autobiography several months ago, and I found it really interesting because there were things I didn't know that basically those guys wanted to be actors.
They wanted to be actors. You wanted to be a rock star.
Yeah, so they fell into folk music as well. So it's you know, it's serendipity the way that some things work out.
I think that it is. I think it is. I think it's also serendipitous that you joined us here on Local Folk right here in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, right where the John Paul Jones house is as well. And there's also, we have another Scottish guy named from Glasgow that you may meet later on. He was one of my guests. He lives here now. But you had years and years with the Battlefield Band, and I'm going to play probably a little piece of them later on just to let people know what was going on. I mean, but you had so many albums. How many albums did you wind up recording? It almost sounds like once you discovered it and you said, this is what we're doing, you just went with it and
well,
just kept going.
Well, Brian, our fiddle player, got really excited when we got our first album. And that was an interesting story as well, because we got to a Celtic festival in Brittany, and we were very fortunate. We were the last on the Scottish part of the bill, the last edition, and we did a concert at just the right time of an evening. It was a very, very hot evening, and there had been a very formal Scottish folk show in this room, and it was really, really hot and stuffy and quite kind of it was a kind of traditional show, not terribly exciting. And at the end of that show, people kind of spilled downstairs gasping for breath, and there was Battlefield Band playing in the ballroom. And we knocked their socks off for the next 40 minutes. And a little French guy with a moustache came up and said, voulez-vous faire un disque? Do you want to make a record? So we were all saying, what?
You said, we?
We want to make a record.
We?
Yeah, we. Three times we. So we made a record in Brittany at an aircraft hangar. A dance studio next to an airfield. And in the first 25, 26 months, we made four albums. We just turned them out, and there wasn't a repetition in any of them. It was like, 12 tracks or 13 tracks in each one. And that was partly because Brian, let's make another record. That was great fun. Let's make another one. So we couldn't keep that pace up, obviously. At the end of my 40 years with Battlefield Band, I made about 27 albums.
That's a couple of albums, more than a couple albums a year.
And there were a couple of compilations over and above that as well. I don't really count them.
At what point, how many years was it from the time that you started the Battlefield Band before you could do it full time? Did you do full time work?
Did you have
a regular job?
Well, I was a field teacher and a field social worker. Civil servant, I should say. Wasn't a social worker at all. But it was about 6 years after we started that Brian and I took the plunge and said, let's try and play music for a couple of years.
Yep.
We can always go back to regular jobs after that.
Is this after you had been already making some albums?
No. But that was coincidental with that story I've just told you about making an album.
Oh, okay.
That was one of the things that made us decide, let's go for this.
Yeah.
And see what happens.
Let's just really go ahead and do it.
Yeah.
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 And then you haven't stopped since. It's great.
Basically, yeah.
I mean, you traveled all over the world. You've literally traveled all over the world with this. You've kind of brought Scotland all over the place.
We played in some weird and wonderful places. The only continent I haven't played in is South America. So, but there's still time, Rob.
There's still time.
There's still time. But, you know, we played in virtually every country in Europe. We played in East Germany before the wall came down. We've played not every country in Europe, but almost all of them. And we played in weird places like Malaysia.
Malaysia.
And Egypt. Yeah. We even played in Syria.
In Syria?
Yeah, a long time ago. We did a little tour for the British Council, which is a kind of cultural arm of the British government. So, you know, we went out there in a kind of diplomatic charm offensive with bagpipes.
Yeah. Well, yes, offensive. No, yeah. No, okay, so this was leading right into my next thought, which was you were real representatives of Scotland, or did you consider yourself to be representatives of Scotland, diplomatically speaking?
Well, I thought of ourselves, if it doesn't sound too grandiose, as kind of, you know, exporters of our culture,
yes.
You know, kind of like folk ambassadors. And the first time we came to the States, there was a kind of similar reaction to that Edinburgh reaction that I was talking about earlier, insofar as the US folk audience hadn't really experienced a band like ours. And the first few albums, we had a very distinctive sound early on. I had this old pump organ that was actually made in Ann Arbor, and that, along with the cittern that Brian McNeil played, gave us a very distinctive acoustic sound. It was almost, if this Disney sound daft, it was almost kind of like a Phil Spector folk wall of sound.
Okay, no, that makes complete sense.
Because we had this big organ, and I kind of emulated the drones of the bagpipes, and then. At one point, because this was an antique organ, it fell apart, and I couldn't get another one that was as good. And then around 1970, beginning in 1979, we changed the band. A couple of the guys left, and myself and Brian went out as a duo for 6 months or so. And then we thought, oh, let's have another go with the band. And we got in a bagpipe player and a female singer. And again, that lifted us up from Phil Spector to folk heavy metal. You know, really loud with bagpipes. And we needed a good sound system. I remember the first time we came to America as well, a lot of places had no sound system at all. Or they would say, oh, we got 3 mics. And a 5-channel board or something like that. And we thought, man, this is the richest country in the world. Don't they have decent PAs?
Well, yeah, I don't know. I don't know where they were.
And that was the kind of, you know, the ultra folky end of the market over here.
So when you were doing tours, you were doing larger places, or, I mean, did it vary over your career? Was it playing towards thousands or playing towards 50,
it's always been varied. It's part of the vagaries of this music. And if you were doing long tours of any place, then there would usually be a couple of duds in there somewhere where you're playing to a very small audience.
Sometimes a small audience is okay, though, right?
Oh yeah, I personally liked playing in large concert halls, but I was equally happy in a bar. If there was a stomping audience and you got that immediate feedback, when you cranked in the bagpipes and people went, whoa!
Yeah, I think so. Hey, you're going to get a definite reaction tonight later on. Listen, I've just been so fascinated with what you've been saying that I've gotten off my off track here. You have a album called The Adventures of John Paul Jones, Alan Reed and Rob Van Sant, and this is your new duet project. I really want to play something from it. What is your favorite track, and can we listen to it right now?
Well, I don't know. What's your favorite track, Rob?
I think John Jones.
John Jones, track number 3. All right, let's see if I can get my CD player decided. It's been so long, my CD player decided to go to sleep. Hold on just one moment, and I will make this happen. There we go. Be back in just a moment here on Local Folk.
There was a sloop sailing on the Potomac, got stuck on a mud bank. She ran aground at the end of last year, and from this sloop there comes a stranger, and he's looking for a farmer that can lend him a horse, get him out of here, get him out of here. Says his crew have deserted him, he's got to find another one right now. In Goochland County, I was there in the springtime. I met with a young man at a plantation where I was a guest. He said that his brother was gone to his maker, and he is a sailor. Says that the ocean, what he loves best, is what he loves best. Says his friends are trying to help him find the ship under commission right now.
You are listening to 106.1 WSCA FM. We are Portsmouth Community Radio. You're listening to Local Folk right now. I'm your host, Steve Kerrigan. And I have two guests in the studio. I have Alan Reed and Rob Van Sant. And they have stopped in on their tour, and they've played in Portsmouth already. And they've brought their new CD with them, of which we just listened to the track. Let's see here. John Jones. Hey, that had a great sound to it. That had a nice groove.
My idea on this album was because John Paul Jones was had traveled to many different places, it would be interesting to write a series of songs and tunes in the folk styles of the different places. So we've got a couple of Scottish-sounding songs, we've got a couple of French-sounding songs, a couple of Russian-sounding songs, and a couple of American ones as well, and some tunes. We've got, a tune called "Across the Piscataqua."
Whoa! Hey, nice. And there it is.
That's my attempt at, you know, a kind of contradance type melody.
A contradance. Yeah, they do that here. That's for sure.
Well, yeah, that's what I was thinking. So musically, it was a very interesting project. As well as, you know, writing the songs and just delving into his life, because it's a fascinating life.
So just to be clear, you were taking influence from all of these different places because this is where John Paul Jones traveled?
That's correct. But I was also dipping into my experience of traveling to different places and listening to music.
Okay.
So, for example, the Breton music is something I heard very early on in my career with Battlefield Band. So I, you know, with my little knowledge of that, I thought, well, I'll try and write a song that sounds like a Breton song.
So this is like a Scots interpretation of a Breton song or of a contra song or of your interpretation.
Yeah. Absolutely, and there's a track on there called Holland as well, which I try and with Rob's help, but when we recorded it, try to do a kind of European waltz type thing.
That's awesome. See, now I just, you know, I'm glad we got the talking, because now I just want to listen to the CD. I mean, what a great concept for an album. Do most of your albums have this type of concept, or?
No, not at all. In fact, that was originally mooted as a Battlefield Band concept album, but I was the only one that ran with it. And the band went on to do another album, which I think was one of our best albums as well, called The Road of Tears. But meanwhile, I had written three or four of the songs that are on this album, and I was hooked on the story, and I thought, I have to do something with this, whether it's in Battlefield Band or not. But because they weren't interested, I said to Rob, well, let's you and I have a go at it. And we started it about 8 years ago, but we had various interruptions, partly because of Battlefield Band tours and recordings, and also we did another album, Rob and I, on Bonnie Prince Charlie. That was a kind of interruption to this project.
Your album was interrupted by another album?
Yeah. Do you want to hear the story?
Well, Bonnie Prince Charlie, that's the Stewart family, was it?
That's correct, yeah. A friend of mine was writing a play about him, and he said, Alan, will you write a song? And I said, yeah, I don't know if I can, but yeah, sure, I'll do that. And I ended up writing four songs. And then he asked me to do a CD that he was going to sell to schools, because he wanted to make this an educational project. So I said, okay. So Rob and I did an album for kids. And then at the end of it, I said, why don't we make this into a proper album and take most of the songs we've done for this schools thing and put in more instruments and change the arrangement a little bit. So that turned out to be an album.
That's great.
And the idea of that was that I was going to write critical songs about Bonnie Prince Charlie, because almost all the Jacobite songs are very romantic and pro-Jacobite and concentrating what a handsome guy he was. And I thought, no, this is a guy who spent 40 years in Europe as a refugee, basically getting drunk and mistreating his women. Let's write something a wee bit harder.
Great idea. Jeez, I'd like to listen to that as well. Hey, I'd love to listen to another track off this CD, if that's all right with you.
Do you want to play that local one then?
Yes, I do. I do. The Providence Bells and Across the Piscataqua. Now, Providence, is that Providence, Rhode Island?
Or? Absolutely, yeah, because he's got an association there as well.
All right, because we're running out of time here, but I definitely want to listen. This is two tunes that were written by the two of you?
No, by myself.
Okay, very good. And So these are Alan's tunes performed on the new album, The Adventures of John Paul Jones. Called Providence Bells and Across the Piscataqua. That was off the album The Adventures of John Paul Jones by Alan Reed and Rob Van Sant, who are both here in the studio with me right now. We're running out of time here, but Alan, what's going on? One quick question. If you wanted to give some advice to somebody that was trying to get involved in the music, what would you, is there anything off the top of your head that you would tell them is a good thing to do?
Well, do you mean any music or specifically folk music?
Maybe folk music.
I think, first of all, go and listen to people that you admire. And if you're wanting to play it, try and, first of all, figure out what it is they're doing and then try and make it your own.
Excellent. Yeah. Make it your own, which is what you've done, right?
Well, I think that's what any folk musician does. That's the nature of folk music. If you look at old songs, there are lots of different versions, which means that either people made their own interpretations, or if you're a cynical old guy like me, they couldn't remember all of the songs, so they just made up the rest of it.
It could go either way. I mean,
both are equally valid.
Yeah. If you consider it a living thing, some people do. The folk music's a living tradition,
It's organic.
Yeah. Hey, what do we do if people want to find out more about you?
Well, we have a website, which is reidvansante.com. That's reidvansante.com. And there you can find out about, you know, where we're touring and what albums we've got. We've got lyrics. A couple of people asked me to put the lyrics on the of the songs because we don't have them on the album.
Yep.
There's a resource there for people to have a look at.
Excellent. Okay.
Should they be inquisitive?
Okay. And how much longer are you going to be here on tour in the U.S.?
We're going to be here. We're going out to the West Coast after a wee stint in Ontario. So we go back home on November the 11th, 12th, I think.
Excellent. Hey, I can't thank you enough for coming in here and sharing with me and my listeners a little bit about yourself and your experiences. Thank you very much, Alan.
You're welcome.
And thank you, Rob.
You're very welcome.
Okay. And thank you, listeners. We will see you next time on Local Folk here on WSCA 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio.
Paul Jones is on the loose again. He's given them the slip again. The news has spread like wildfire. Paul Jones is on the loose again. And every harbour watch will scan the sea with anxious eyes. In the taverns and the gin shops, they're debating his intentions. And the arguments rage over what will be his next surprise. He sailed up the coast of Ireland to the Hebrides and Shetland, taking prisoners and prizes on the way. Then he turned his squadron south until they reached the port of Leith, where the sight of them brought panic and dismay. The sight of them brought panic and dismay. Paul Jones is on the loose again. He's given them the slip again. There was uproar in Kirkcaldy when the squadron drifted over there. A minister prayed on the beach, forgot to intervene. The capital itself was spared from looting and from ransom when a storm blew up and Jones's fleet were forced to leave the scene. They sailed southwards to Northumberland and then towards the Humber, pausing once to threaten Tyneside on the way. And from Scarborough to Grimsby they sent out for the militia as the Jones flotilla scoured the coast for prey. The Jones flotilla scoured the coast for prey. At last a fleet of merchantmen were spotted close to Flamborough. A gunsloop and a frigate were the escorts by their side. The frigate was the Serapis, the newest and the fastest, and with 50 guns, the finest that the Navy could provide. Paul Jones has sailed his ship, the Bonhomme Richard, into battle and has grappled at close quarters with his foe. This desperate fight has ended with the Serapis dismasted, and her captain has surrendered to Paul Jones. Her captain has surrendered to Paul Jones. In the mansions and great houses, they revile him as a traitor. In the taverns and the gin shops, they debate if he's a thief. And the broadsides have portrayed him as an evil, swarthy pirate, with eyes as wild as stallions and a row of gleaming teeth. But across the English Channel, he's acknowledged as a hero. He is feted as a champion in France. And America reveres him as the man against all odds who led the Royal Navy on a merry dance. Led the Royal Navy on a merry dance. Paul Jones is on the loose again. He's given them the slip again. Paul Jones is on the loose again. He's given them the slip again.